Greetings and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm your host, Monica Black. As you know, we at New Books in History take it as our job to pick out exciting new books that the world needs to know about, and we interview their authors. And today we have the distinct pleasure, I have the distinct pleasure, of talking to William Davenport Mercer about his new book. It's called Diminishing the Bill of Rights, Barron v. Baltimore and the Foundations of American Liberty. It was very recently published. It only appeared just a few weeks ago with University of Oklahoma Press. Dr. Mercer teaches history and law at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville. And his book starts off with a seemingly small event long ago, the purchase by John Barron Jr. and John Craig of a wharf in 19th century Baltimore. And then it ends up, the book ends up, that is, by explaining something very large and very contemporary, that is why Americans today in the 21st century view the Constitution as the source of our rights. That is a very interesting story and beautifully told in this book, and it all starts in the mud at the bottom of the Baltimore Harbor. So thank you, Bill, for being with us today.
Well, thanks for having me on. I appreciate your comments on the book. Thank you.
Yeah, no, it's a lovely book. I enjoyed reading it so much. It's quite a story and really fascinatingly and expressively told. So maybe we can start that way. We can start just by, I'll ask you please to kind of tell us about how you got interested in the subject and, you know, what led you to this particular case and what was the trajectory of writing the book?
Sure. The book comes out of obviously the case Barron versus Baltimore. It's one that I remember learning about very briefly in law school. It kind of gets kind of passed over rather quickly. And I got more interested in it, actually my first semester of grad school, through a conversation I had with my dissertation advisor. And we were both talking about how it seems like a bit of an anomaly, especially if you know anything about Chief Justice John Marshall's general historical trajectory. It seems like a kind of an out of place decision. And so as I got to looking at it more, it was one of those fun projects that as you keep digging, you keep kind of thinking, oh, there's more here. And it went from a short seminar paper over time to this book.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell me, can you tell us a little bit about how, what kind of research went into this book?
Sure. It of course starts small and seems to expand out as these books often do. I started very, very kind of narrowly looking at the case, of course, itself. And then the scholarly literature that was explaining why it was doing what it was doing. And then from there, kind of looking at it more as a question of the narrow issue at hand before the court, but the larger question of what do Americans think about their rights and where do they think those rights come from? And so the sources tended to branch out from there. You know, of course, you have the court cases and such, but also I found a lot of good documents up in Maryland and in D.C. The Maryland State Archives, where I first started out with this. The City Archives came online a bit later. I found those to be really invaluable in that a lot of those documents had been really not terribly cared for until the state got involved and started funding the City Archives so that scholars could get in there. And I found a whole host of information on Baltimore itself to better place what exactly was happening so that it kind of contextualized what Barron and Craig were actually going through and what they were up against. So mostly we're talking the Maryland Historical Society, the Baltimore City Archives, the Maryland State Archives, the Library of Congress, even the the National Archives. I'm sure everyone who's done one of these has had that piece where they spend an inordinate amount of time running down one piece of evidence that you know is going to end up being one sentence, but you still spend time doing it. I found an old audio recording that was done back in the early 80s that was an audio play about famous Supreme Court cases. And amazingly, they had Don Ameche narrate one about Barron versus Baltimore. It's great. And I was like, I have to find this. And fortunately, went up to the College Park branch and kind of pigeonholed the guy who was really nice enough to say, well, look, we don't have it today, but I know you traveled. I'll mail it to you. And he did. And I think it ended up being one sentence, but still very satisfying.
I'm sure it was a very important sentence, too.
It was a great sentence.
No, all historians, every historian who's listening right now is thinking, yes, I know exactly what he's talking about. Whether you work in archives or in manuscripts or in some other sources, everybody knows exactly what you're talking about. Well, fill us in a little bit for the uninitiated. I am no longer uninitiated having read your book, but for the uninitiated, what exactly was the case? I mean, who was Barron? Who was Craig? Why a wharf? Why Baltimore? Kind of give us the story.
Sure. The story here is as follows. I mean, you have two guys in early 1800s. We're talking right after the War of 1812, right on the heels of the War of 1812. John Barron Jr. And his business partner John Craig buy this wharf in Fells Point. Now, if you haven't been to Baltimore, Fells Point is approximately 1 mile east of downtown. The significance of that is that the Patapsco, the harbor, dead ends into downtown Baltimore. Today, that'd be downtown and where the Orioles play and such. Fells Point is interesting because it's 1 mile farther up the river, meaning that ships that need to come into Baltimore to load and unload have much less of a time dealing with a narrow harbor that's choked up by sand and silt, which in Baltimore, given its elevations, is a constant problem for this really rapidly growing place. And so they buy this wharf, and very quickly things really don't go well for them. They buy it. Of course, they're not terribly rich people. They buy it on a note. They have a number of payments that they have to make from the guy they bought it from, and things rapidly seem to fall apart for them. They make the first payment okay, but Baltimore itself seems to, in many cases, overextend what they thought the post-war prosperity was going to be, and Barron and Craig are kind of part of that. I mean, there's a fever outbreak that occurs right in their neighborhood. There's a freezing, but more importantly, there is the sense that Baltimore, as the third largest city in the country, it needs to get its act together, and in many ways, Baltimore and Craig feel that they've been sacrificed on the altar of progress, so to speak. The city recognizes that the way of doing business in Fells Point has to change. And when I say way of doing business, the idea of allowing streams to just run through the middle of Fells Point can't work. I mean, if you even look at old maps, there are places, one of them is called the Brick Pond, which is just essentially a retention pond that just springs up on one of the blocks. Muddy streets, carriages, people trying to walk through these, animal excrement, the silt coming down from the hills. It's kind of a disgusting, nasty mess. And so from the time that Barron and Craig have bought this place, the city takes these measures to try to clean up Fells Point. They cut street, they make dams, they make embankments. And the long and the short of it, to kind of to wrap this up, long and the short of it is the city finally takes all the water that's pouring through Fells Point and redirects it so it empties into the harbor at one spot. The problem is that one spot is directly north of their wharf. This, of course, you know, the water not just being clean water, but water running through Fells Point is carrying everything with it. So it raises the level of the seafloor around their wharf, making it harder and harder for them to dock the big ships. And when you own a wharf, you make money off of rent. A wharfage is what they would call it. And so they no longer have the ability to dock these big ships and ultimately end up losing the wharf because of it.
Yeah. These guys had a lot. One of the things that comes through your book very clearly is how much bad luck these guys had.
Yeah, certainly. Even little things like the fever outbreak. I saw this and go, oh, you got to be kidding me. These guys, they just can't catch a break.
They could not catch a break. And I think that piece of context about the outbreak is very interesting and maybe not something that every historian would have picked up on. So I thought that I found that very, I mean, maybe that's always been a part of the story, but I thought that the way that you highlighted it was particularly interesting. Not just because these guys, it becomes actually kind of comic how many pieces of bad luck fall in their laps over and over again, but also, I mean, as a historical fact, I thought that was very interesting. Could you tell us now a little bit about, now we have a sense of the story, at least the beginning of the story. We know more about the mud of Baltimore. Is there anything else about Baltimore that we need to know to sort of understand the way the story develops further?
Sure. I mean, one of the other things to think about with this, and I found the Baltimore City Archives really helpful in this regard, the sense that what's taking place in Fells Point and the story of Barron and Craig kind of feeling they're getting worked over by the city is by no means unique. And in fact, when they sued, you had two other wharf owners right next to them who hired the same attorneys and sued at the same time. You've got the city that's kind of trying to get up to speed, and they seem to be trying to get up to speed all at once, and people are really freaking out about this. If you think about Baltimore, I mean, it's almost like it blinked itself into existence. I mean, it's really kind of coming out of nowhere. You see the same crises happening downtown where they're trying to straighten the wharves, they're trying to extend roads, and you have these battles in the newspapers, for example, that are almost reminiscent of revolutionary era dialogue. You know, people using fake names, Civitas and Publius and such, to write anonymous letters to the editor, the editors whom plead with the public for more time because they can't publish all of these over. Who should bear the brunt of these costs? You know, I mean, who pays for it? So for example, you want to extend a street downtown. Who pays for that? Should the people in Fells Point have to pay for that? They don't live downtown. You know, what kind of city is this going to be? There are charges of corruption rampant. And so what I tried to do in the book is to try to kind of take the Barron story away from what we would most commonly know it as a Supreme Court story and say, look, the Supreme Court story is almost just the very end of this. This tells us something much bigger about growth in cities like Baltimore in this era that are all dealing with, you know, what's the best way forward and who has to pay the cost. And what's the role of law in this? And how is the role of law changing to accommodate these developments?
Yeah, I mean, these are actually issues that we still deal with now to one extent or another. They haven't necessarily gone away.
No, absolutely not. No. I mean, you see this, the takings jurisprudence, well, the Fifth Amendment and the obligation to pay for takings of private property has long since been held as applying to the states. That by no means means that the problem has gone away. It's just you've got inverse condemnation, you've got regulatory takings, and there's say amongst lawyers a very healthy business still thriving among all that. Yeah.
Well, how does it go then from being this sort of local story, in many ways, very local story, to being a much bigger story that extends even into our own time? So how does it, I mean, to begin with, how does it become a constitutional issue?
Sure. The short answer is very slowly, but it gets going, right? Here's the kind of the timeline here. By 1822, they filed suit. Now, it's important to understand that these guys have they've lost their wharf. They are in no business to be funding litigation, and they have a kind of an erstwhile benefactor, a man by the name of Luke Tiernan, who not only kind of steps in to give John Craig advances from time to time to try to keep him afloat, but ultimately tries to negotiate with the purchaser the seller of the wharf for more time. When the wharf is sold out from under them, they lose the lawsuit. The seller sues them for unpaid monies. It gets sold and Luke Tiernan buys the thing. And so there's no question that Tiernan is the one that's really funding all of this largely as, I think, a speculative venture in order to make some of his money back. Barron and Craig are from then on really kind of, I think, parties in name only. He hires good attorneys. He gets a good local guy, Charles Meyer, to bring the case. Files in 1822, and to show that not much in the legal profession has changed with respect to the brevity of our lawsuits. It doesn't go to trial until 1828. But what's interesting is, and again, this is kind of goes back to what I said earlier, that the more you kind of kept looking at this case, the more interesting it got. So who ends up getting pulled in? So Charles Meyer's a good local attorney. They also then bring in David Hoffman, who in legal circles is notorious or known for being one of the first legal educators in the country. And when I say legal educator, I mean someone who's doing it in kind of a school setting by teaching kind of classic readings as opposed to the old apprentice model where you read Blackstone and copy motions and such. He comes in for Barron and Craig. On the city, you've got John Scott as the city's solicitor, which is fine and good. But as they get closer to trial, they bring in a very well-regarded Baltimore attorney by the name of Roger Taney, of course, who becomes John Marshall's successor as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, also infamously known as the author of the Dred Scott decision. So he makes his appearance. So you can see things are starting to get more serious here. It finally goes to trial in 1828. Craig dies shortly before trial. Barron dies shortly after trial. But what's interesting is they win. The case is successful. They get damages. The problem, though, is that's not the end of it. The city appeals the judgment. They go to the Maryland Supreme Court, known as the Court of Appeals, and ultimately the city gets a reversal. Where this becomes bigger as a matter of law kind of nationwide and for our purposes is that Barron and Craig's attorneys then decide we need to get this into the Supreme Court. John Marshall signs this and wants the case, and I argue that by the time in between the time that he signs the writ of error, the thing that gets it to the Supreme Court, and the time that the case actually gets heard, that some pretty significant things have happened that make a decision in favor of Baron and Craig really not possible from his perspective.
Mm-hmm. So before we get to sort of the decision and the importance of the decision, let's back up for just a second and I'll ask you to kind of explain to us how Americans in the early Republic thought about their rights and where their rights came from. And it's probably going to be helpful to most people like me who aren't specialists to understand how differently people conceived of the source of their rights in the period that you're looking at, as opposed to the way that we conceive of them now.
Yeah. The interesting thing you find about Americans and say the early Republic, so you know early 1800s, is that there's no uniform consensus. If someone said, if you have a right to do something, well, where does it come from? You know, like I mentioned this in the book. You know, in modern parlance, you know, we say right all the time. There's a right to this. There's a right to that. I mean, we throw it around so much, it's almost considered elemental. Like we don't even examine what we mean by the term right at all. Americans in the early Republic era had a pretty rich kind of palette to choose from if they were trying to figure out where their rights came from. I argue that by the early 1800s, you generally have kind of a winnowing down into a couple of different categories. You have rights as provided for by the common law, which I think is still the biggest category. And when I say common law, of course, I'm speaking of going back to English case law. The term comes from when the courts in England, specifically the royal courts, were trying to produce a brand of justice that would help kind of the authority of the crown. You had numbers of courts, manorial courts, ecclesiastical courts, for example, that all had limited jurisdiction. But by sending out the king's judges to ride circuit, they could create a brand of law that would be common to the realm as opposed to limited jurisdiction courts like manorial courts, for example. And so that's considered by Americans in one strain of thought is very much their birthright. You know, you see in the colonies, in their charters, for example, that they are entitled to the rights of Englishmen. And when they say the rights of Englishmen, they're speaking of things like the common law. You think of something like the Magna Carta of 1215, for example, as a centerpiece of the common law. One of those centerpiece provisions was the right that no man should be deceased of his property except by law of the land, which, of course, you know, we see a version of in the Fifth Amendment that doesn't come out of nowhere. And so by the time you get to the early 1800s, that, of course, is still kicking around as your rights are common law rights, are customary rights, and judges simply enunciate those customs. It's inherently conservative. It takes a long time to change. But that's a big part of it. I think you also see another strain of thought. You see Americans talking about the rights as existing either by natural law or natural right. The contours of the overlap between those two are always a kind of a source of consternation for academics. I try not to get too caught up in that debate, but try to think that you have rights as existing somewhere, you know, in nature. You can kind of consider it as being moored either to kind of the heritage of rights as you know by the divine in some way. You could also consider it, and many of them did, you know, an outgrowth of the rise of international law, especially in the 1600s. where people are trying to create law, but internationally you don't have one sovereign you can just attach it to. So you have this idea of trying to create these broader natural rights, things that you would kind of today see in more of like a human rights context. And so you see that shot through a lot of case law and legal opinions as well. I think a third source of rights that I think has kind of winnowed down into the 1800s or early 1800s is rights as positive law enactments positive law, essentially actions by like legislatures, for example. Statutes would be positive law. And you start to see that's coming online as well. And I think in many cases, it's an outgrowth of the American constitutions that are being written that are, declaring rights. But over time, I think it's a pretty short step to starting to look at those same documents as the fountain of rights. This rights as positive law enactment, I argue, is how Marshall looks at it in Barron. And then the last category is one of those maddening things for historians, because not everything fits in a neat little box. People blending it. You'd see two, three of these in say like a same judicial opinion, where they're just kind of all over the map. But point being is, for rights to matter in this era, they don't have to be tethered to any sort of written document. I find that's the minority view, though. Today, no lawyer is going to walk into court and claim a right and not have some kind of document that they can enter into evidence and show the judge.
So interesting. So how do we get from a place where the sources of rights were many and they could be used in various combinations? The sources, that is, could rights could be seen as being generated by multiple sources in some cases. How do you get from that situation to the situation that we have now, where we see our rights as somehow emanating from the Constitution? And what was the role of Barron v. Baltimore and the Supreme Court in that change?
Well, I think it's a slow transformation. Like Barron is interesting in that, like, we have this sense, and especially today, get online and think of the tea leaves that are being written about Neil Gorsuch right now. Mm-hmm. Just the speculation, and we're hanging on every word. Now, what kind of breakfast cereal does Kagan eat? Will that tip something? But think about that. So I looked at the newspapers that had the reporting for the Supreme Court, and they, first of all, the Supreme Court is not really the Supreme Court like we think of it today. It was in the basement of the Senate. There were much bigger things happening in the Union at the time, and the newspapers that were reporting the Barron case would give no one any indication as to the magnitude of the issue before the court. So you don't see state courts actually citing Marshall's opinion for years. In fact, the trial court's decision was published in a magazine called The American Jurist. And that gets cited for decades, and it tends to get cited more than what Marshall wrote. But what's interesting, though, is that over time, the Barron decision becomes like an article of faith. So by the end of the century, you have courts that are talking about Barron as if that's the way it's always been. And anyone who would ever question it just must be out of their mind. How could that possibly happen? The best analogy I could probably give, there's a line from a rock song that says, "I've drank enough whiskey to turn a battleship around." Now, that's a mixed metaphor. But when do people start thinking of their rights differently? It's like turning a battleship around. Barron did not, I want to make it clear that Barron wasn't the thing that did it, but Barron was a step in it. And Barron is important because we then can look back at it and say, well, this is the Supreme Court, and we can look back at it with our kind of, you know, we think of the Supreme Court as everything and say, oh, then see, look, it's always been like this. And it's not, but it was an essential piece in kind of getting us to where we are today.
Yeah. You know, I've heard, it may not be true, but I have heard that you figure out a way to get Barron into almost every class that you teach somehow.
That's kind of true. Yeah. 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 If you take one of my classes, you probably have to hear that word at least once.
You're going to know something about it when you're done.
Yeah. Yeah. Hopefully I can stop doing that at some point. You know.
So when you teach it to students, when you're talking about it, if you have a room full of undergraduate students or maybe a room full of law students, what's the thing that you tell them if they didn't know anything else when they left the room that they would know one thing about Barron? What is it? What's the takeaway?
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, the takeaway is we have to appreciate that the way we think of rights today, is not the way we've always thought of rights. And that's important because I think if you consider, for example, the Constitution as the thing that grants your rights, or maybe to be more charitable, for a right to matter, it has to be in the Constitution. I think that explains a lot about the Kagan breakfast cereal analogy. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it forces us to really strange ends. You know, the one I talk about this in the book, like anyone who's ever had to read the birth control case, Griswold versus Connecticut, 1965, there's a case, a law in Connecticut that outlawed birth control. And it's the Warren Court, it's the 60s. The legal community is ready to do away with this as a relic. It's uncommonly silly. The problem, though, is you read the Constitution, and the words right to privacy don't exist anywhere in it. And so you've got this really weird conundrum. Everyone recognizes that privacy is something that we value and that this Connecticut law needs to go away. But if you consider that it has to be in the Constitution to matter, and then you read the decision, and the majority comes up with this kind of odd penumbras. Well, it's not in there, but if you take the First and you take the Third and you take the Fourth Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, and you put them all together, and you can read that it, in the interlocking shadows, the right to privacy exists. And you're like, on one hand, you're like, no, I want the right of privacy to exist. I want this law to go away. This needs to be there. But on the other hand, if you kind of take it dispassionately and look at a decision like that, you realize that seems like kind of silly reasoning. And I think that's the reason why Barron matters. You know, a right to privacy existed as a matter of the common law. But if the Constitution is where it all kind of begins and ends, you got all of us trying to pour everything into a document that wasn't, we're all looking for answers in a document that wasn't designed to give us all these answers. It was designed to do very specific things, to solve very specific problems in the 1780s. We're making it do everything. And by kind of making it do everything, I think you have certain kind of costs.
Yeah, and then you're back to the tea leaves.
Back to the tea leaves, which is never a good sense, yeah.
No, it usually isn't a good thing. That's exactly right. Well, you've given us a lot of time, but I hope you'll just answer a couple more questions.
Of course.
One thing I wondered about was what you're working on next. Are you working on something related to the early republic and legal history, or what sorts of projects have you got going on?
Yeah, thanks. I've got a couple of different projects happening right now. I'm kind of interested in figuring out ways that I can tell legal stories through kind of traditionally non-legal sources. Mm. Especially if you do constitutional history, generally we've all been hashing through most of the same stuff for a long time. You know, I find intellectually, I'd like to be able to move my stuff in a slightly different direction. So, for example, I'm just finished this piece about a trial that took place in Knoxville that is kind of horrific in a number of ways. But the piece that I think is interesting is that I found a lost ballad that memorialized the event that was recorded 50 years later. And I argue that both the ballad and the trial were performances. And so trying to puncture this idea that there's certain things that are legal and official, like trials, and that there's other things that simply reflect official things like, you know, the arts or music. And I think if we position these differently, I think you can bring all of these pieces of evidence onto the same plane. So I'm working on that. I'm also in the very beginning stages of a co-authored project with a colleague of mine at the University of Florida about blue laws and stand-up comedy. But where we're hitting this, and where I'm having a lot of fun looking at it, is that we're not doing the you know, Lenny Bruce, George Carlin, Richard Pryor stuff, though, you know, as great as that is. I'm trying to figure out, like, how was comedy done in the late 1800s? So if you don't have the proverbial brick wall and the smoky comedy club, where did you do comedy? And how did you do comedy? And what were the restrictions on your speech in comedy? And to that, you got to go into vaudeville, and you got to go into burlesque, and you got to go into the concert saloons. And what I'm finding is that speech restrictions are not necessarily just governmental things, but speech restrictions are market driven. They're the desire to clean up the theaters and make more money. If not, you'll get a note in a blue envelope. You can't work blue. So that's what I'm working on right now.
It's very interesting. I had no idea that the blue laws, extended back into the 19th century. I mean, that's just my ignorance talking, but that's just absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, I'm learning a whole lot myself. It's pretty great stuff. So hopefully I'm hoping it comes together.
If you can make your scholarly life connect with things like burlesque shows and blue laws and Richard Pryor, then you're bound to be doing something right.
Absolutely. I did one part just as a bit of an intro, and I legitimately got to read a book about Bill Hicks, and that was for work. And that was fantastic. It was like the stars were aligning. I'm working and reading old Bill Hicks material, which is always fantastic.
That is fantastic. One other thing I happen to know about you, just by the way, is that you're a guitar player, and I wonder if you would maybe tell us now that your book is done, how playing a guitar solo is not the same as writing a historical monograph.
Yeah. I would say they're pretty different. Cause unless you're in like a prog rock or, some kind of a like crunchy jam band, which, I am not, fortunately, you only got a couple of bars to burn it. And, whereas a historical monograph, oh my, it just goes on forever.
It is a lengthy undertaking.
It's like they're never done. They're just finished. Fortunately, I think my students don't want to hear about it anymore. But I still feel like, if you want, you could probably jump in and keep looking at this sort of stuff. But I would say they're different in that way. But in some respects, I will say. They're both very creative. You always want to try to do something that's interesting. You want to do something that isn't just a cop of what everyone else has done. And at the end of the day, you hope people don't throw stuff at you when you're finished.
That's exactly right. Well, we've just had a tremendously interesting and engaging and funny conversation with William Davenport Mercer, who teaches history and law at the University of Tennessee. His book is called Diminishing the Bill of Rights, Barron versus Baltimore, and The Foundations of American Liberty, very recently published by University of Oklahoma Press. I urge you to pick it up and read it. I urge you to find a copy and learn something new, I think, fascinating about American history and the way that we came to our contemporary understanding of the source of our rights, and learn some really interesting things about the city of Baltimore. I'll say that too. So thank you very much, Bill, and thank you for your time.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me on. I really appreciate it, and I hope people that listen to it like the book and as well. I will say there's a lot, of course, we can't get to in this, but if you are interested, not only is John Marshall make an appearance, but Andrew Jackson is here. There's a whole host of characters. John C. Calhoun threatening to tear apart the Union is there. There's a whole bunch of really interesting things that I had a lot of fun kind of discovering and talking about. And so if anyone happens to pick it up, I appreciate you checking it out. And I really hope you enjoy it.
Thank you, Bill.